opening up trade and tourism to Cuba. This morning, we take your calls. And good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in on this chilly morning. I hope you're having a good start to your day. I'm Melissa Ross, and just ahead, we'll take an in-depth look at what normalizing relations with Cuba will mean for the island's people. You can get on the line right now. We're already getting your calls. Let us know what you think. 549-2937 is the number to join the show. Then later, how a local think tank is helping small and disadvantaged businesses here in Florida level the playing field when it comes to federal contracts. All of that ahead. But first this morning, reaction is still rolling in after President Obama's momentous decision last month to normalize relations with Cuba. Reaction to this huge foreign policy change has been mixed, with many Americans saying it's time to try a new approach when it comes to the communist island nation. However, for the large Cuban exile community, mostly in South Florida, the shift has been greeted with anger and disdain. And one question many of us have is, how are Cubans reacting to the news? Well, this morning, we're taking a closer look from a man who lived in Cuba. Tracy Eaton is a journalism professor at Flagler College, and he's also the former Havana bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. He joins us now with his thoughts about the changes coming to Cuba. Tracy Eaton, a pleasure. Good morning.
Thank you.
Good to have you on the show. And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the decision to normalize relations with Cuba? Do you think it's a long overdue change or a mistake? Well, give us a call. 549-2937 is the number to join us. 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. And we also welcome your comments on Facebook. So you spent 7 years in Havana for the Dallas Morning News. Been at Flagler College for some time now. What was your reaction when you heard about this decision last month coming out of the White House?
Well, I was surprised. I was in Havana when the announcement was made, and I went out right away and started to talk to Cubans on the street to find out their reaction. And people were, for the most part, overjoyed. One woman I talked to broke into tears as soon as I asked her the question, and she said, you know, enough blood, you know, enough conflict, you know, we've got to end this. And so, I mean, people were visibly, I mean, one woman came out in her nightgown and was waving her arm. She was so happy. So there was a lot of excitement.
So the average Cuban wants this change, you think?
I think so, yeah, for sure. I mean, it's been more than 50 years of hostility.
And why has it been such jubilation on the island? Is it the prospect of opening up trade in particular, having access to goods and services that perhaps they couldn't get before, and also the opportunity to visit relatives and have people visit the island?
Well, the economy in Cuba is so ragged. I think people are welcoming any kind of change, you know, just hoping that things are going to get better. Wages are still $20 a month for most Cubans, and that's just not enough, you know. So I think people want change.
What's your reaction, meanwhile, to the fact that in this country, reaction's been mixed? In particular, Cuban exiles based here in Florida, many have been quite critical of this, saying that we shouldn't reward a totalitarian repressive regime on the part of the Castros. We shouldn't reward them by opening up trade and tourism with this country.
Well, for sure, I think there's risk in making these changes, you know, that Obama announced. After hearing the news, one of the first people that I tried to find in Cuba to talk about it was Hector Maceda, who's a former political prisoner and husband of Laura Poyan, who was the leader of Las Damas de Blanco, or Ladies in White. And I wanted to know what he thought, whether he thought the human rights situation might improve. And he said, no, he doesn't think so. He said, I don't trust this regime.
Hmm. Lots of calls. And if you're just joining us, let us know right now what you think about the huge decision after 50 years of no relations to normalize relations with Cuba. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. So you were based in Havana for the Dallas Morning News. What was it like day-to-day living there?
It was really interesting. I was there for 4.5 years, and I learned a lot about Cuba, and I feel lucky to have been there as an American journalist trying to figure out a country that has, you know, it's the size of Pennsylvania. It's not a huge country, but it has had an outsized impact and has had a key role in a lot of events in U.S. history, you know, the Cold War, Bay of Pigs, Cuban Missile Crisis. So I found it to be a fascinating place.
How, in what way? What are some examples that when you remember just the sights and smells and the day-to-day, what stands out in your memory?
Well, it's like going back in some ways to the 1950s or 60s, you know, all these old American cars, you know, chugging down the street and old colonial buildings, you know. I mean, if I could be transported back in time, I'd like to go back to 1958 to see what that was like, because I'll bet it was really interesting.
In fact, after this decision was announced, many travel writers and travel pundits were saying, go visit Cuba now while you can still experience this time travel feeling, because they think that in a few years, globalization is going to wash over Havana as it has most other major cities. Do you agree with that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I read the other day the chairman of and CEO of Caterpillar, Doug Oberhelman, he said in an interview, "We can see Cuba down the road in a few years, maybe like Puerto Rico. I don't know if it would be the 52nd state," he said, "but there's a lot of Cubans in the United States who would like to see that." And I'd say to that, well, not so fast. I mean, you know, I don't think it's so easy to untangle U.S.-Cuba relations that have become such a mess after 50 years of hostility. And I think this is going to be a process that takes years, not months.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment. For Tracy Eaton, he's the former Havana bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, now a professor at Flagler College. And we want to know what you think about the move to normalize relations with Cuba. 549-2937. So, the embargo is still in place against Cuba unless Congress acts. That isn't likely. So establishing diplomatic relations with Cuba, how much effect do you think it will actually have on the lives of everyday Cubans who, as you said, suffer under low wages and a totalitarian regime?
Well, I think at least the two governments will be communicating more regularly. They'll be talking, and maybe this way some of the problems between the two countries can be resolved. And what impact that'll have on people, I think one of the biggest things is as Cubans get more money, as more Cubans start businesses, as there's more trade, they'll be less dependent on the government. And I think that there's a certain amount of fear and paralysis in the Cuban government, you know, because they see that as people become less dependent on the government and on the Communist Party, they're going to be less loyal. And so I think that could, in its own way, undermine the Cuban government.
Do you think it could lead to the eventual fall of that style of government?
Well, I've always thought that change in Cuba is going to be painful and slow. And for now, I'm stick with that.
And why, based on your experience living there, that's what you think?
Yeah, because, you know, the Fidel Castro spent a lot of time trying to set up a bulletproof government. And by bulletproof, I mean a government that's going to stay in power. I mean, staying in power is the big objective here. You know, mm-hmm. It certainly hasn't been to become a prosperous nation. I mean, that hasn't worked. The economic system hasn't worked.
The lines are jammed, meanwhile, because it certainly is a hot topic here today on First Coast Connect as we ask you, what do you think about the move to normalize relations with Cuba? Let us know. 549-2937. Celicia in Jacksonville. Hi, Celicia. Good morning. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Buen dia, Melissa. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
And you too.
I'm so grateful that you have your guest on this morning. I have been to Cuba twice with my church. The Episcopal Diocese of Florida is sister diocese with the Episcopal Diocese in Havana, Cuba. And, you know, unless you can see it for yourself, you really cannot believe Cuba. And my description is very simple. Cuba is a beautiful lady with a dirty face. Mm. If you can imagine South Beach not having been painted for 50 years, that's what you'll see. And it's just, it is frozen in time. The idea that we're hurting Castro is so, we are hurting the people, and it would be just such a fantastic thing to drop this barricade, this blockade, and help these people.
Celicia, thanks for the call. Someone who's pro-ending the embargo, Garrett in Riverside. Hey, Garrett, what are your thoughts this morning?
Yes, good morning. First off, I want to say that my dad came over from Cuba in January of 61. And so half of my family is from Cuba and fled the Castro regime. And I've realized that there's a split in the opinion between that generation of immigrants and the ones that came over in the 80s. And the older generation is not in favor of this. They think that this will only benefit the Castro regime and that all the money will go straight to them and not the people. And that specifically at this point in time, Cuba is in such a stranglehold because they've had support from Venezuela and Russia in the past, and that is starting to diminish. So
right.
Maybe perhaps the time to not normalize relations is right now. I was wondering what your guests had to say about that.
Yeah, thanks, Garrett. Thank you for the call. He's right. Older Cubans in the exile community here in Florida in particular have been making those arguments. What do you think, Tracy?
Well, I think that we should all have a lot of respect for the struggle and the pain that Cubans have gone through. You know, Cuba is a nation that's been torn apart. There's 11 million Cubans living on the island. 2 to 3 million Cubans live outside the island, and families have been divided. And I think that they've gone through difficult times. You know, people have been thrown into prison. People have been beaten for expressing their views. So I think we've got to have a lot of respect for Cubans who have gone through all that. Right now, there's around 90 Cubans in jails in Cuba for political reasons. And the Cuban government's tactic lately has been to arrest dissidents and then release them. It's kind of they call it catch and release. So there were 8,899 such people arrested in 2014, and that's four times the number arrested in 2010. And so I think it's a serious problem, you know, and something that the United States, I think, is going to continue to try to fight.
And as aid from Russia and Venezuela trickles away, that had been propping up Cuba. What about the argument that as they lose that source of funding and aid, that now isn't the time to normalize, that if those countries aren't propping Cuba up, that could be what finally topples the Castro regime?
Well, trying to strangle Cuba economically hasn't worked so far, and Cuban Americans have really been leading the way in throwing their own families in Cuba a lifeline. There's more than $3 billion in remittances are sent over there annually, and around 500,000 Cuban Americans visit per year, and that also gives a big dose of help to Cubans.
That's been helping families, yeah. We have a lot of Cubans on hold, by the way. Ed in Orange Park is Cuban. He's been waiting. Hi, Ed. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Wonderful guests and great calls, as always, Melissa. Yes, this is the problem that exists here. This is the worst time to lift the embargo because, like you mentioned, the Soviet Union and Venezuela have been the deities of the Cuban regime up to this point. Soviet Union is no longer existing. Russia has a lot of problems. They're not sending money to Cuba. The new one sending help to the regime is Venezuela, and they're in deep trouble themselves. So at the time, for the first time in 50-plus years, the totalitarian government of Cuba is losing the indispensable economic support because, like you guest mentioned, the economy of Cuba has gone into basically bankruptcy. Now we're going to be the one who are going to turn in the lifesaver and save the government. I have debated Cuban government officials in public forums many times, and I ask one question always, and I'm waiting for the answer, which is, name one item necessary to the Cuban economy or the Cuban people that you cannot buy anywhere else outside the United States for the same or basically cheaper. And I'm still waiting for that. So the embargo being connected to the economic situation, horrible economic situation in Cuba, has nothing to do with it. As the president, when he made his speech opening the relations, he mentioned about telecommunication equipment that now basically blaming the embargo for the lack of it. I ask everybody listening one question. Look at your cell phone, your computer, your fax machine, and your printer, and see what they're made. They're not made in the United States.
Yeah.
They're made in Korea, in Taiwan, in China. They will be more than happy to sell it to Cuba. The problem is the Cuban regime doesn't allow the citizens to have it.
Thanks, Ed. Yeah. Thanks for the call. Thanks for that. And we've got a few more Cubans waiting. It'll be interesting to get their perspectives. Tracy Eaton.
Well, I think if you look at the steps that the Obama administration has taken, certainly the officials have been clumsy in some ways because there's been quite a lack of transparency. We don't know all the details of the deal that the U.S. government struck with the Cubans. There's supposedly 53 political prisoners that are supposed to be released. A few already have been, but there's no list that shows who they are. And I think that fuels suspicions about the deal and gives people the impression that Obama gave away the farm.
Really? The prisoner swap in particular, you think?
Well, I'm just saying that I'm reading a lot of criticism of the administration over the mm-hmm. lack of transparency mm-hmm. in the deal.
Larry in Mandarin, another Cuban-American with us. Hi, Larry. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Well, my name is Larry. I've been so far in the U.S. for 3 years. And, well, I came here as a refugee because I was actually out from the university there because of my political thoughts. And, well, the funny thing is, even there in Cuba, people still talk that the main problem, that the main blockade, the main embargo problem is between the government and his third people. And it's kind of interesting because the question is why it is happening right now. The government is still blocking people access to internet, to information, and that's the main reason why it is happening.
Yeah, Larry, thanks for the call. And that's true. Very few Cubans, right, Tracy, have internet access. They can't access a free flow of information.
Exactly. And to connect to the internet in Cuba, it costs the equivalent of about 2 weeks' wages to connect just for an hour. And,
yeah.
And so the internet connection rate is on par with some countries in Africa.
Right. And so would it really take hooking the country up online to force any real social political change?
Well, I think that certainly would help create greater awareness in Cuba of human rights abuses and other things. I mean, it certainly would help.
Lots of tweets coming into the show. We have an opening to normalize relations. We need to take advantage of it. We don't know how open the next leader will be. And Ryan tweets the show, we already do trade with dictatorships like China. If anything, increasing trade will spread our ideas and democracy. And let us know what you think about this historic move to normalize relations with Cuba. At 549-2937. Lots of callers. David in Ponte Vedra. Hi, David. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Earlier, you mentioned that the CEO of Caterpillar said that if we open up relationships, we could make Cuba the 52nd state. Well, what is the 51st state?
His suggestion was that Puerto Rico was like the 51st state. So that's what I think he meant.
But Puerto Rico is a possession.
I know.
Right. It's really more almost of a colony, you know. When you think about it, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I realize that, but I think that's what he meant.
Okay. Well, I would like to see Puerto Rico and Cuba state. That would be great. But I do want to go to Puerto Rico. I want to go on a cruise ship, and I want to go to Havana, have a glass of wine and smoke a cigar in Havana. I think that would be so great. I want to do that.
I think so many people do, David. Thanks for that call. So many Americans have that desire.
Yeah, and now with the changes that Obama made, when Americans go, they can actually bring back
some rum and cigars.
Exactly, exactly.
And let me ask you too, like, you lived there, so you had access to all of those things. Psychologically, it's that sense of forbidden fruit that makes people want these banned goods all the more. Now that people will actually be able to get them, will they lose some of their allure?
Yeah, I think definitely. When I lived in Cuba during the Clinton administration, well, I mean, I've been traveling to Cuba since 1994, and during the Clinton administration, those who traveled there legally could bring back $100 worth of stuff. I would sometimes bring back cigars, give them to my bosses. They loved it.
Oh, of course. Sarah at the beaches. Hey, Sarah, good morning. What are you thinking this morning?
Good morning. I have thought a lot about the lifting of the embargo, and I really feel that the Cuban people themselves, the individuals, would not benefit that much. There are no businesses in Cuba that are privately owned. Wages would not go up. I'm not sure that their health care would get any better. Plus, I don't know what Cuba has other than cigars that they could trade with the United States. The Bacardis are already here in Jacksonville. I don't think there's going to be any other rum coming in. Tourism would be wonderful. Cuba is probably one of the greatest untapped fishing areas for sport fishing in this part of the world. So that would be nice. But I really don't feel that the Cuban people would benefit very much.
Sarah, thanks. Do you agree, Tracy?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of things we just don't know about how this is all going to shake out.
Yeah, there's really, you don't think it's possible to predict, do you?
Well, people have been trying to predict what's going to happen in Cuba for a long time. I remember a 1992 book called Castro's Final Hour predicted the demise of the regime. In 2006, the National Intelligence Director, John Negroponte, told the Washington Post that Castro was near death and had months, not years, to live. 2010, Newsweek said it would be look to be the last year for Castro. Well, Castro is 88 now, Fidel, and his brother Raul is 83. They're still kicking.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it's a hazardous business to try to predict what's going to happen in Cuba.
But at a certain point, obviously, both brothers will pass on. And then what?
Well, I think that some of that has to happen for there to be change in Cuba. Because as long as they're around, there's been a lot of resistance to really overhauling the system.
Let's go now to David in Keystone Heights. Hi, David. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Doing great.
Cuba, I hear these people talking about great fishing, wanting to sit on a back and drink wine and smoke a Cuban cigar. They have no earthly idea what goes on in Cuba. My wife is Cuban, and I have been there, and I've been to the places that are not set up for tourists. Cuba is horrible. The people are dirt poor. In the country, the part where I went, they still sleep on dirt floors. I'll give you a story about Cuba. My wife's sister-in-law, they have 4 light bulbs, 1 13-inch TV, and that's it. That's the only thing, and a refrigerator. They got a knock on the door one day, and it was the Cuban government, Cuban soldiers. They took their refrigerator because it made ice. They told them they were burning too much electricity. They gave them a new refrigerator and said, you buy it or you have no refrigerator. It took half of the man's salary for the next 6 months to buy that refrigerator. That's Cuba.
Yeah.
The hospitals in Cuba, I went to a city of about 70,000. If a window gets broken, it stays broken. A lot of the rooms that we would consider a two-person room, semi-private, would have 8 people in it. They come around with a barrel every day. You bring a bucket from home. They put the water in that bucket. That bucket is for you to drink, to bathe, and any other use you have for water. There's no running water inside the rooms. Cuba is a hellhole. And the fact, it just infuriates me, the fact that Cuba is down to a point now where it can't last much longer. And these people are going to lift this government up and keep it alive. Cuba has no money, but they have beaches, beautiful beaches, and mountains, perfect places for resorts and sports fishermen and people to eat or to smoke cigars and drink wine on the back of the porch. That's what's happening. Big money is going to go over there and make it even worse. Mm. They're going to keep the Castros in power. They're going to keep that communist country the way it is, and they're going to ruin everything that's been done. That's my opinion.
All right, David. That's David in Keystone Heights. Thank you for the call.
Well, I have a lot of admiration for Cubans who endure all that they do. I mean, over the years, they've come
up... Do you agree with his assessment of how dire it is?
A lot of Cubans are very bad off. Some things are changing in Cuba, though. There's 450,000 entrepreneurs there now who have small businesses. That's putting more money in people's hands. And so things are changing.
They've eased restrictions on opening up small businesses somewhat, right?
Yes, yes.
That's gotten a little looser.
Yes.
No, nowhere near what we would take to be as normal, but for them,
right.
It's progress.
They're still heavily taxed. There's still lots of problems, but they've made some progress in that area.
Let's get a few more of you on the air. Joseph in Orange Park. Hi, Joseph. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I am very thankful for being able to voice my opinion, to make observation. Thank you very much. I'm listening to the many observations people are making, and people should make observations. But I do not believe that Cuba should have embargo for another 50 years. It is not right. We have a few people here. We have some South Florida say, let us keep shut off from Cuban people. It is not right. China is trade partner with the United States. Why not make a move to Cuba? We have to take small steps. Cuba will not open up completely tomorrow or the next day, but it must be a start. And I listen to people about the Cuba Castro brothers. They're not going to be around for a long time. There are many good things about Cuba. And I heard all these bad things they talk about Cuba. How yes, there are poor people in Cuba. See, but many people talk about Cuba. They don't know nothing about Cuba. And they say, I live in Cuba. My wife is from Cuba. Oh, so what? So what? Many of us know about Cuba. Some of us have lived in Cuba. Some of us with little children in Cuba. And some of us have lived in Cuba and before Fidel Castro, somebody like myself could never go beyond fourth or fifth grade. But now you get a better education in Cuba. And Cuba cannot stay closed. It must be open. And it's going to be open. And Mr. Obama, President of the United States, made a good decision.
Okay. Thanks, Joseph. So he's pro normalization. And Theo at the beaches, let's go to Theo. Hi, Theo. Good morning.
Good morning. The Department of Treasury oversees the embargo, and you can go to Cuba and have been able to go to Cuba for quite some time. There's actually two flights a day leaving out of Miami. I've received permission from our government and have been to Cuba five times, and I could not agree more with the desire and the need to open up Cuba with regards to more openness from the relationship with the United States. The Cubans want a better Cuba, but they also tell me quite clearly that we have the wrong impression of what they want. They want a better Cuba, but they don't want a better Cuba made in the USA. They want a better Cuba that they themselves craft. And the lifting of the embargo will make untenable the grip that the Castro brothers have had on Cuba. When hundreds and hundreds of thousands of American tourists flood Cuba, the Cuba people will benefit, not officially through their government paychecks, because the government will take a bunch, but there's an underground economy that functions phenomenally there now. Most Cubans make more money in the underground economy than they do in the official economy. And hundreds of thousands of American tourists will only benefit that. And as Henry Kissinger said, of course we talk to our enemies. You've already got your friends. And this is the way that we will influence the future of Cuba. It won't happen because we snap our fingers, and it won't happen the way we would have it happen, but it will happen the way the Cubans themselves have it happen, and this will help hurry that along.
Theo at the Beaches, thanks for your thoughts. And so, Tracy Eaton, as we wait to see how this unfolds, what are your final thoughts?
Well, I agree with your guest, the caller. You know, I think Cubans want to go their own way, and the U.S. government has had a certain sense of entitlement when it comes to Cuba and has wanted to control Cuba's destiny. One report that came out some years ago even said that the government was ready to help Cuba plan how to map its coral reefs, how to organize the bird trails for bird watching, how to treat wastewater. I mean, minute details that the U.S. government wanted to be involved with. And, you know, that's been going on for years, that the U.S. government wants to control everything in Cuba. But Cubans there, they want to do their own thing. You know, they don't want to be controlled by the U.S. government.
They want to determine their own destiny.
Exactly.
Fascinating to speak with you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Tracy Eaton is a professor of journalism at Flagler College, and he's also the former Havana bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. And coming up, why small and disadvantaged businesses in the state say they're being shut out of big opportunities. How a local think tank, though, is helping level the playing field. That's in a moment.
Pot is legal in some states, but if the feds won't have it, how are you going to buy and sell?
Let these legitimate businesses have fair taxes and banking services. They'll be better off, but so will society.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Legal marijuana businesses and why they're still paying their bills with bags of cash. We'll tell you next time on Marketplace from APM.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Spend some time in The Square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville invite you to vote for your favorite submissions. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about The Square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Even the savviest social media users learn the hard way that not all platforms are created equal. Twitter, for example.
In that setting, my snarky comments came off as overly petty, so I deleted the Twitter and then told everyone to go to my Facebook and we could talk about it there.
Becoming more sophisticated at managing social media later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Travel back in time with Radio Theater, Doo-Wop Revival, The Great American Songbook, and Juke Joint. Throwback Sunday, Sunday nights beginning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT. Looking forward to looking back.
Welcome back. Well, it's an allegation that hundreds of thousands of small businesses vying for federal contracts have been illegally excluded from those opportunities. But a local think tank is working to give small and disadvantaged businesses in the state a leg up. Raul Espinoza, founder and CEO of the Fairness and Procurement Alliance and managing partner of the Umbrella Initiative, is here now with more. And Raul, Happy New Year. Good to see you.
Good to hear from you, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
And the number to join the show as we talk about this think tank and small business in the state is 549-2937. Okay, so what's going on here? Bring us up to speed.
In 2005, the organization was formed following the a landmark decision that pointed out a lot of the abuses that were taking place. 10 years now today, actually this month, the organization had also another victory, which highlighted the fact that there are many, many barriers that are preventing minorities, women, and veteran-owned businesses from participating in a $700 billion marketplace.
And when you say barriers and abuses, can you give us some examples?
There is basically set aside 23% of all federal contracts are supposed to be set aside for small businesses. Yet large businesses, for example, are taking a large chunk of it, and the government itself are looking for ways to circumvent the regulations and not setting aside what is called as simplified acquisitions, which are contracts between 3,000 and 150,000. So those are just the tip of the iceberg, and those are the things that we are focusing on, trying to bring in attention and at the same time make recommendations on how to overcome them.
And let us know your questions about the Fairness and Procurement Alliance. We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. So tell us about your organization and its efforts.
We were established in 2005, and at the time it was four advocacy groups supporters in that fight. It was a landmark decision at the federal court. And recently we won another major case, which highlighted the problem. And in that, give you an example, only 10% of all the GAO protests are basically sustained. And only 3% of those are raised by simplified acquisitions issues. So we were able to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that there are a lot of barriers and that are not be addressed by the government. And that's kind of where we're focusing on.
And so how do you combat that?
We are trying to transform the think tank that we created, which back in 2005, now into a policy center, academic policy center, at one of the Florida universities that we are participating, we like to keep it here in the Bay, in the First Coast, and we do have a lot of, especially attorneys from Florida Coastal School of Law and UNF, that have been assisting us with research and to address those problems and making recommendations on how they can be eliminated.
And let us know your thoughts and questions as we go to the phones. 549-2937. Al in Jacksonville. Hi, Al. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you doing today?
Great, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to personally thank Raul for coming into our offices at Client Focus Media yesterday. He and I have been friends since 2010. I came from Connecticut, where I work for a minority supplier. And I concur that between the government and large businesses, a lot of people talk through both sides of their mouth. And for lack of a better term, Melissa, it is a good old boy network, and sometimes you've got to go into the game with a baseball bat. And I think figuratively, that's what Raul does, and he does a great job of it. And one of the things about Raul is he came from Cuba during that Peter Pan program, and I would love for him to talk about that a little bit on your show.
Okay, sure. Thanks for the call, Al. Can you tell us?
Yeah, it was very good that you had the previous speaker.
You're a Cuban-American too.
Cuban-American,
yeah,
too.
Right.
The problem, I believe the problem has to do with the way in which the decision was reached without involving Congress. Change is good, especially when the status quo hasn't achieved the objectives. However, my biggest wish is for the activities that are initially undertaken that be focused on education and on health and maybe infrastructure that would benefit directly the people and not the government, because we can't trust the Castro brothers. We have never been able to. They have never been basically honest with their own people about what they have kept and they have pretty much destroyed the entire economy.
But in terms of what Al, the caller, had to say about that, you're going in with a baseball bat and smashing away the restrictions of the Good Old Boys Network. Is that how you see yourself?
Well, I don't like to see myself as that. People often perceive me that way because I am very determined. That's kind of how I overcame adversity. I didn't give up. I persisted and was good to my principles. And that is the way in which we have to overcome the problems because, frankly, the biggest problem is the government itself. They are not... They are circumventing the regulations. They are rigging auctions. They're rigging the solicitations. They're doing anything they can when they want to do it to keep the status quo. Those who, you know, large corporations spend billions of dollars lobbying to keep the monopoly on government contracting. And again, the issue is, here in the state of Florida, for example, we have a $74 billion that are being spent in public solicitations. At the federal level, we're talking about $700 billion, and if you take that nationally, we're talking about $3 trillion. So, these groups, and I'm talking about minorities, women, and veteran-owned businesses. In order for them to be able to help the economy and participate and create jobs, they have to have a level chance to kind of participate and bid on those contracts, and they're not being allowed to. That's what it comes down to.
So where do you take this from here?
We are very hopeful that by transforming the think tank that has been working very diligently in that arena into a full-fledged academic policy center, we will have the weight to affect change, and that's kind of what I'm focusing on. We are going to start a campaign to raise $3 million to establish this, and are negotiating with several universities right now to select the one that would allow us that opportunity. The victory that we had, for example, is one where we convinced that there is a problem with what's called reverse auctions in the government, that they are only benefiting the government in terms of the dealing with. The sellers don't have any opportunity, any fair opportunity to participate. And we convinced that the rules are kind of need to be changed. And I'm hoping, again, that we will be able to affect change by the recommendations that we make.
Well, keep us posted.
Certainly.
We'll continue to follow it. Thanks for being with us.
Excellent. Thank you for the opportunity.
Raul Espinoza is founder and CEO of the Fairness and Procurement Alliance. And we're back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
I'm Ira Glass. On This American Life, we break down tough economic concepts into concepts anybody can understand, like those no-income, no-asset mortgage loans that accidentally brought down the world economy.
It's almost like you pass a guy in the street and you say, you lend me $540,000? He said, well, what do you do? I got a job. Okay.
Making the boring and the inexplicable interesting. This American Life, Saturday afternoons at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the road or at home, chill out with the Electro Lounge, only on 89.9, Tuesday to Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, what does the worst urban fire in the history of the southeastern United States have in common with the Jacksonville Landing? In a word, opportunity. Our occasional commentator Jay Solomon explains in this edition of With All Due Respect.
Within 2 weeks of the great fire that gutted 146 blocks of downtown Jacksonville in 1901, reconstruction was underway. Architects, drawn by the blank canvas the smoldering ashes represented, came to town and created the future. Leading the charge was Henry John Clutho, a proponent of the prairie style emerging from the Midwest. Bold new structures emerged. Many notable examples of Clutho's buildings still exist, including City Hall, the Morocco Temple, and the Clutho Apartments in Springfield. Fast forward 113 years. Now, I'm not suggesting Jacksonville's downtown resembles the devastation after the fire. Just the opposite, really. What we have is a city on the cusp of remarkable change because of all the great projects moving forward. Consider Hemming Plaza improvements, the redevelopment of the Hayden Burns Library, and the opening of the Sweet Pete's Complex in the repurposed Seminole Club building. There are new restaurants, pubs, clubs, the Laura Street Trio, built following the fire, and including the Clutho-designed Bisbee building, are coming back to life. Plans are in the works for the long-dormant shipyards property on the North Bank and the former J.E. Power Station site on the South Bank, and core urban neighborhoods are exploding with activity. There's incredible potential, and one big question mark. The centerpiece on the river, the underutilized, often maligned Jacksonville Landing. Nearly a year ago, the city and developer Tony Sleeman were talking about complete demolition and new construction. However, designs unveiled in late summer were attacked as uninspiring for this unique location, and planning halted abruptly. But as the year ended, a new approach was emerging. A design firm with experience in urban riverfront design is to be selected to work on concepts for the property. After years of struggles, that's great news. It's akin to the burned-out heart of the city after the 1901 fire, a tremendous opportunity to create new and compelling icons for the heart of the First Coast. Remember when the current Hyatt Regency Riverfront opened as the Adams Mark in 2001? Disappointment reigned. Architecturally, it had all the charisma of a 20-year-old warehouse, a missed opportunity. We must not miss with this one. Imagine the possibilities. Actually, I'm raising my hand because I have an idea to consider from another urban waterfront, Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland. Located where the North Atlantic and Arctic Oceans meet, Iceland is a big volcanic island about the size of Pennsylvania with a small population, roughly 320,000 people, about 500,000 fewer than the city of Jacksonville. Icelanders had desired an opera house for more than 100 years before construction finally got underway on the Reykjavik waterfront in 2007. In a country beset by daily volcanic activity and earthquakes, the facility, known as Harpa, was clad in exterior walls of glass. But it was a financial earthquake, the economic collapse of 2008, that broke the project. There was talk of abandoning Harpa, but the national and local governments took over the financial load in 2009, and construction finished in 2010. The Observer of London called Harpa a wonderfully brazen emblem of Iceland's refusal to sacrifice culture in the face of crisis. It is an incredible signature building which soars like a wave while reflecting the sea and the sky in its oddly shaped and multicolored glass facets. As the light changes, Harpa changes. Sometimes we see the interior. Sometimes it projects reflections of Reykjavik. At night, it wraps itself in a cape of lights. Iceland is a country of astounding beauty accented by almost continuous variations in light and weather. Harpa embodies all of that. Visitors see an iconic building, but as they look at it and through it, they see Iceland. Why would a larger, richer, blossoming city like Jacksonville want or accept anything less? I'm not saying copy Harpa, but certainly what we see when we look down Main Street to the St. John's should reflect our community's vitality and spirit. With all due respect, I'm Jay Solomon.
Jay Solomon is a retired broadcast executive and WJCT volunteer and an occasional contributor to this program. That was this edition of With All Due Respect. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. The show's producer is Sean Birch. Our intern is Annie Black. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you've got feedback about the show, we want to hear it. Just drop an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Next on Diane Rehm, President Obama meets with his Mexican counterpart, Enrique Peña Nieto. Their agenda, it includes trade, security, and immigration. Guest host Susan Page and her guests discuss the latest on U.S. relations with Mexico and how they might affect our evolving relationship with Cuba. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. On tomorrow's show, what happens when two local churches decide to blend and join forces? One congregation mostly Caucasian, the other mostly African American. It's a Jacksonville story, and we'll bring it to you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.